Oh my God. And I'm not nervous. Good morning, folks. My name is Hank. I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
And our sermon for today is Love is the Answer. And in case that doesn't fly, I got another one for you. Came to Believe. And if that doesn't work, we're going to go right into the language of the heart. And guess what? They all go together. Boy, I felt the love here this weekend. It's been marvelous. And now I understand why you call it the Emerald Coast Jamboree. I had opportunity to walk your beaches. And not often enough. I could have stayed out there from sun up to sundown because I'm a damn Yankee. Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm... What do you call those people from up north? Okay. It has been exciting. It really has. And I'm so grateful. I'm grateful to Aretha for calling us in November when the snow was starting to come down up there and saying, what's the weather like up there in February? I said, what are you kidding? It's still snowy and it's in the 20s and it's cold and it's windy. And that's when she said, well, how would you and Mary Lou like to come down to the Emerald Coast Jamboree? Oh, you didn't have to ask twice, Aretha. And the committee, thank you, committee, not only for inviting us, but for the job I've seen you do this weekend. I didn't get as many as Mary Lou did, but those little hearts, a hug for each heart. Well, I got more hugs than I have hearts here, I'll tell you that. And I appreciate that. And you just made us feel so welcome and so much at home down here. And then I realized, gee, I'm not the only transient. I met somebody here who I knew up in the North Country. And he's in the Navy, and I thought we weren't going to see any more of Ralph for a while. And I come down here, and he was the Northern Illinois Area Alternate Secretary. And we thought we got rid of him. You know, he's causing so much trouble up there. And he told me how he's leaving, and then I'd get down here, and somebody else had found and keeping him sober 6 years as of 2 weeks ago. Congratulations to you, brother. As was said over the weekend and more than once, you know, that feeling of love and the sharing. And when I heard the first speaker Friday morning, a very familiar lady, a real close friend, and I was over there with Aretha almost in tears because she got a little emotional at one time during her talk. And I got a little emotional when she got emotional, and I look at Aretha, and she's getting emotional, and I'm thinking, and I think, I'm not going to do that this morning. I'm going to stay cool. I'm going to stay loose. And yet, as was said by Slayton, my goodness, it sounded like the roof was coming in, really. And I was teasing the guy who does the sound out there, and I said, I don't know how you're going to do it, but I would like you to take that background sound out of my wife's talk. And I said, I know they can do that in the FBI. So he said, why don't you take the tapes to the FBI? But I was just so doggone proud of her and the fact that she kept on keeping on. And it was so nice of Mary Pearl to give her that little button that she's wearing there. Through all that noise and everything, you know, she kept on keeping on. My story is not unique. And certainly my background is not unique. I thought it was for a while. I thought I was different. I was born and raised in Buffalo, New York. And that might cause for the accent that I have. You may not notice it down here because there's a lot of transients I've noticed, like I said. And I'm not the only one with that northern accent. Even Bill, you know, God love Bill with his 40 years sobriety. And he's a snowbird, I understand. Is that a good thing to be called? Born and raised in Buffalo, New York. Mom and Dad, I was born in the mid-30s. And Mom and Dad were divorced right after the Second World War. But not before Mom had presented Dad with three lovely daughters and one son. And they were divorced right after the Second World War. And she remarried. Oh, by the way, my dad was a Mohawk Indian. And I have a lot of fun with that. And I'll tell you why. She remarried, as I say, right after the Second War, divorced dad, remarried another Mohawk Indian. Come to find out, they're from Canada. The same reservation up there at the Six Nations in Brantford, Ontario. And I didn't know this till I got older, but there were boys in both families. And there was this big rivalry always going on between the one faction and the other, my stepfather's and my father's people back then. And as he would have it, in 1948, my mother presented my stepfather with a bouncing baby boy, my brother Mike. So Mike has my stepfather's last name, I got my father's last name, and here we are, cutting through life as brothers. I know what you're talking about. Poor Mike. I was bigger than he was. I was 13 years older than he was. So as he was coming up, you know, he's my baby brother. And we had a lot of fun. When he got old enough, I started to take him around and teach him a few things. My stepdad drove and trained harness horses. And Mike went with my stepdad. I traveled with him for a while. And we decided to part ways because I saw other guys around the track were making more money than I was. So I quit my stepfather, went to work for a little Italian guy from Caledonia, New York, and he took us out to Chicago after we wintered horses down to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And that's when Mary Lou said, there she was in this roller skating rink across the street in Maywood Park. And I came across from the park, it was the end of February, and I'd just come up from Myrtle Beach, and I didn't have any winter clothes. So I went over there just to keep warm. There she was, skating around, like she said. And she fell down, and I was kind of bashful then, believe it or not, and I sent my buddy out to pick her up, and he did, and then he brought her over and introduced us, and that started a chain reaction. Mary Lou and I dated for, well, from the end of February till the 5th of June, 1954, and I remember it because that's the day I made my first proposal of marriage to her. I was 19 years of age and ready to settle down. So I did propose to her, and she said, no. I went back to New York State, traveled to Syracuse, New York, Roosevelt Raceway, Vernon Downs, and she kept writing. And I decided she'd had her opportunity, and I'm not going to answer her letters. And I didn't. Didn't write to her. But I decided it was enough of the horses, and I joined the Army. End up down in, after basic training, end up at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. At the end of my second 8 weeks of basic, and some of you guys may have been there. Of course, I know we've got a lot of Navy and Air Force around here. But at this particular time, at the end of the second 8 weeks, these gentlemen come around, spit-shined boots, dressed snappy, and wings on their chest, and they're talking about airborne. And the two guys that I signed up with in Buffalo, they thought it was a great idea. I thought they were crazy. But I figured I'm going to go along with them. So we signed up, and we went airborne. Now, in basic, right after getting my wings, I'm writing to the young lady. I met a guy from Chicago who I got to thinking about Mary Lou, not that I'd ever really forgotten her, but I was so mad I wasn't going to write. And I started writing to her, and she answered, and we started dating again. And I would hitchhike. I never thought of it until after I'd been sober for a while, how weird that I was. At one time, I would hitchhike from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, down near Clarksville, Tennessee, all the way to Chicago for a weekend date, for just a Saturday night. Now, if my kid did that, I'd say, what are you, some kind of a nut? And he did, I'll tell you that in a little while. But I guess I was in love, and on one of these dates, I proposed to her again. And she said, no. Now, I've been trying to understand you women. You know, I was brought up by my mother and three sisters. So I figured I had an inroad into the psychology of the female mind. This one was kind of, you know, throwing me off a little. I didn't know where she's coming from. I get down to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I call her up. I'm telling my outfit's leaving next month. We're going to be gone for 2 years over to Japan. But if you're not doing anything next weekend, how about coming down here and let's get married? And she said, all right. Now, I'd been introduced to booze back when I was 8 years old. When I'd had strep throat or whooping cough or something, Mom gave me a warm beer. And somebody said, if you remember your first drink, you might have a problem. Now, I don't know if there's any reality to that. I just happen to remember that was my first drink. And I remember how good that tasted and how good it made me feel. And the only other time I could really recall getting that buzz again was when I was working on this farm during high school years, milking cows. And Butch Conrad took me over to the barn where his dad made this Applejack. And went over there, took a glass of that, and I rode my bike home. And then I saw that movie E.T., and I remember just how I felt riding that bicycle home. It was just like that. It was really... I was up there. Now, I drank around the racetrack, but I didn't get into too much trouble with drinking when I met Mary Lou. Even though the drinking age in Buffalo, New York was 18, and in Chicago, Illinois, it was 21, it didn't bother me because I wasn't really into it. But I went to Japan, and Mary Lou stayed home. And over there, the only thing we had to do was go to the EM Club, like some of you guys might do and did, and then out on the town. And I went out with some guys, and they knew how to drink, and they were going to teach me how. And I was a very good student. I learned quickly. They had, for those of you who've been there, and he mentioned it the other day in his talk, is Torrey's whiskey. Terrible stuff. Oh. They also had this nice sweet wine, red wine called Akadama. And they sold it in quart bottles. And the boys I drank with taught me that before you go to town and do any serious drinking, you buy a quart of this Akadama and you chug a lug. Where's your home? The bottom of the bottle. And we'd do this crazy sort of thing, and then some of us would go off to town, and others would stay there and have a second. Like I said, somebody has more capacity than others. And anyways, it did the job. By the time I got back home a year later, Mary Lou, it was like the movies. Like one of those commercials where there she is running through the field. And I'd just gotten off the bus, and I saw her, and I asked the sergeant if I could leave the bus in the formation, and he said, go ahead, and there I was. And there was a fence between us, and I went right over that fence, like, you know, hurdle. I was never too much into athletics, but boy, I looked good that day. And I grabbed her, and we hugged one another, and she let me drive this new car. I'd never had a car in my entire life, and she let me drive this car. And here we are in this brand new 1955 Ford four-door, and I'm driving on the wrong side of the road. But you're in Japan, you know, they drive on the other side. She suggested maybe she should drive. That was a good suggestion. As a matter of fact, it even worked better later on. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I had no idea about AA. I'd seen some drinking in the family back when. But I think it was rather usual, you know, back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and families would get together just prior to TV, and the weekends were party time, at least in Buffalo, New York. I don't know where you come from, but Friday and Saturday night didn't make a damn what you had in the refrigerator. It was time to go out and party. And they did, and I watched them, and I kind of went along, and I thought it was exciting, and I didn't think it was a problem. I didn't think my dad had a problem. Although Huey would travel from the Peace Bridge in Buffalo, New York to Niagara Falls. And everybody knew my dad. He tap danced. He's a self-taught tap dancer, and he's an entertainer. And he had a good time. And every place we'd go, and he'd take me with him. Hey, Chief. And he didn't remember anybody's name. You know, he'd see all these people, and he'd act like he knew them all, but he didn't know anybody. And he'd tell me. I said, Dad, you know all those people? He said, well, son, the important thing to remember is to be friendly. And if somebody reaches out their hand to you, then you reach out. But if they don't, then you mind your own business. Okay. But every place we walked in, hey, Huey, hey, Chief. And I thought, but he's so popular. Why doesn't he run for some kind of office, they said in the family. Well, because he wasn't sober all the time. And they kind of knew that about Dad, you know, up now. Anyways, had a lot of fun in that regard, in respect that I drank there in Buffalo, didn't have a problem, didn't drink there in Chicago, and didn't know anything at all about alcoholism. Come back to the States, and Mary Lou and I set up housekeeping, and as she said, I went out with the boys a little, which, you know, that didn't seem unusual either. Except she was a little upset when on occasion they would have one guy on each arm and one guy on each foot and bring me into the house. And that went with the drinking, didn't it? I mean, sometimes, if you drink, that happens. And I didn't think anything of that either. Understand, since I come around here, that there's this progression. And, you could have told me about it then. I wouldn't know what you're talking about either. But it finally did get to the point, after Kim came along in 59, our first daughter, and Karen in 61, and Hank in 64, and my progression, my drinking was going on, and it was getting worse. And as she said, I celebrated after each child was born. Boy, did I sell cigars, boxes of cigars. I passed out lots of cigars because I frequented a lot of different places. I didn't think anything of that either. She did. It wasn't until finally, after we moved out of the Chicago area to Princeton, that the drinking really got to the place where I could recognize that there may be a problem. Because Mary Lou was starting to act different. I mean, she'd been a little testy when we were in Schaumburg. At one time, I recall, and I'm not telling her story, really, but I was embarrassed for her. I was out a little late, and she had packed my bags and set them out front on the stoop. And I came home, and the sun was just coming up behind me, and I stepped over it and into the house and went to bed. And she said she didn't sleep with me. She slept on the sofa. So I had a clean line right to the sack. And I didn't know it until the neighbors started telling me about the bags being sitting out there in front. I thought that was rather embarrassing for her. Somebody mentioned the other day about packing the bags and unpacking the bags. And either she'd pack them or I'd pack them. And that started when we moved out to Princeton. And it was getting progressively worse. She would be waiting up for me at the table. God love her. It'd be 2:00 in the morning. And, you know, I'd been drinking all day. And I'm tired. I'm ready for bed. It's been a long, hard day out there. You know, people think it's easy. You got work at getting drunk. As drunk as I was getting. And sometimes during the day you have to sober up a little so you could drink again a little later. There was a trick, and I don't want to make this gross, but there was a trick that I had. I don't know if you did, but if I had gotten started too early in the morning and it was getting around noon and it was hot out and I knew there was going to be the 4:00 drinking hour and my buddies would be getting off work, then I would just go out and do whatever is necessary to clean up myself and wash up and throw up and get ready for the 4:00 schedule. And I never thought anything of that. Then when I get home at 2:00, you know, I put in a rough day. And she's sitting at the kitchen table. Can we talk? Yes, certainly. Get a bottle of scotch out, sit down at the table, go ahead. And she'd tell me. She told me something that I didn't hear. She said, "Can't you see what you're doing to yourself?" And I said, "Sweetheart, if there is a problem, let me tell you what it is. It's you." Now, I go down this list of resentments, some imagined, some real, you know, pepper it a little with truth and a lot of fiction, but enough to make her feel guilty, and I had her going bananas. And it really did get to the point where I felt she was about one step away from getting in one of those houses. Not houses. And I didn't like that. My mom had, after my brother Mike was born, she'd had one of those problems with after you give birth to a child and she'd gone into this depression. And they tried shock treatments on her to get her out of it. And that didn't work. And Mary Lou and I had visited her in Buffalo in the hospital, state hospital there on a few occasions. And there were times I thought that I'd like to be in there to kind of hide away from everything and everybody. And I could see I was driving my wife that direction. And I really didn't mean to, nor did I want to. But I looked at this situation, and every time I would mess up or do something wrong, whether it was automobile accidents or whatever, I'd try to make a joke, make it light. I mean, hey, I walked away from the car, so it's, you know, there's four wheels left and there's nothing left other than that. But look, I'm here. Only one scratch here and one back here. But I'm all right, you know. So everything was always a joke. And I took Mary Lou to visit my mom this one time when I was still in the service. And we got to Buffalo, and it was around 9 o'clock in the evening. We just pulled into Buffalo. I went right to the hospital and walked in and see if I could see Mom. And they saw me coming in with Mary Lou. And this nurse there said, excuse me, are you taking her out or bringing her back? The look on Mary Lou's face, just like that. And she was ready to duke it out with this nurse. And I said, my God, don't do that, or they'll really put you in that jacket. All the time, when she started going through these problems and feelings, and I was seeing what was happening, I didn't like it, and I started to think, there's a problem. There's definitely a problem, and I think I need help. She went into the other room. She came back with this phone number. And when I found out she'd been holding on to it for 2 years, was I surprised. But I thought, well, I better give it a call. And I gave a call, and this guy by the name of Ben, who's gone to the Happy Hunting Grounds, God love him, Ben answered the phone in that sweet, loving voice of a member of AA who's been around for a while. He says, hello. I said, is this AA? Yeah, what do you want? I said, I think I may have a problem with alcohol. He said, can you go one day without a drink? I said, well, hey, can I go? Of course I can. It's okay. He said, I'll pick you up tomorrow. Take you to a meeting. Now, Ben lived over in LaSalle, 20 miles east of us. And the meeting he was going to take us to was down in King's House, 20 miles south of me. Well, I didn't know any of that at the time, but Ben came over and I excused myself for a moment to go get a jacket. And it was just the end of April, first part of May. And went upstairs to get a jacket, and Ben thought I went to get a drink. You know, he didn't trust me at all. And I went to my first AA experience. I don't know if it was a spiritual awakening. I'll guarantee you it was an awakening. Because I went to my first AA meeting at this place called King's House, and there were about seven or eight guys, no women, just men sitting around a table. And they poured me a half a cup of coffee. And I thought, cheap bunch. But when I started to pick it up, I spilled it. And then I think I understood why only the half a cup, but they start going around the table and introducing themselves, and they're saying who they are and that they are alcoholic. I mean, I listened to all these guys, and they're talking around the table, and it got to me, and I said, my name is Hank, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't believe that for 1 second. But when in Rome, went home, Ben took me, dropped me off in front of the house. Remember two things. Don't take that first drink and make as many meetings as you can. And he sounded like a sergeant I had in the service. So I stepped back. I give him a salute. Yes, sir. And as he drove away, the thought went through my mind right away. Don't take that first drink. One never hurt me. But make as many meetings as you can. Sure, I'll go to their meetings. Matter of fact, I found out that we lived on South Euclid. And at the Presbyterian Church, just the other end of the street, next corner, they had meetings there every Tuesday night. And I went. I was so proud. I was going to meetings every Tuesday. And of course, first I go to Lefty's. I go to Lefty's, have a couple of beers, and then go to the meeting. And I sat there thinking, I really remember this. Sat there thinking, here's a whole hour I'm not going to drink. And I hadn't even heard about progress, not perfection yet. Oh, wow. You know, I'm not going to drink for this hour. And I'll be darned if I kept coming. And there was a guy, got 40 years sobriety this month. And his name is Eddie B. And we call him the Tiskawa Plowboy because he writes for a paper down in Tiskawa, and that's his byline. And old Eddie, he wouldn't say much. He'd just smile at me. And he'd shake his head. And he'd smile at me. Every time I come to the meeting, there's Eddie. Hi, Ed. And at the end of the meeting, Eddie'd say, keep coming back. Well, I'd go out and have a couple of beers after the meeting. Then I'd go home. But there was something different going on in my life. I wasn't having any blackouts. I'd had some of those. I wasn't having any automobile accidents. I'd had enough of those. Things were changing. I was coming home. Almost regular. And she could almost, you know, tell when I was coming. It was really getting different. But then this, excuse the expression, smart-ass AA member by the name of Doug. Doug from Hennepin. I come to the meeting, like I always did, from lefties. And Doug put his arm around my shoulder after the meeting. I mean, Ed smiled at me. He said, keep coming back. But Doug come up and he put his arm around me. He said, Hank, he said, we have a tradition in here. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the way you smell, it's obvious you ain't got that yet. He said to me, why don't you go back out there and have some more fun? But he said, and this is the important thing I remember. He said, but remember the door swings both ways. If you want to stop, come on back. What a message. I only got the first part. Dashed down the street, into the back door of the house, up into the kitchen, and said to Mary Lou, guess what? I don't have to go to any more meetings. The guy down there told me so. Now, I started going to AA meetings May 2nd, 1972, and the way I remember it is I wrote this note to Mary Lou at the end of that meeting. And I promised her, it was one of those promissory notes, that I promise, as of this date, I shall never drink again or write out any more counter checks. We had those counter checks too, where I... And I signed it and I dated it and that was it. And the next morning I was out at Lefty's. But when I signed it that night, I was sincere. I really meant that at that time. But I just started going back into the old way I always went. So it wasn't easy. I mean, it wasn't hard. It wasn't difficult at all for when Doug said that, for me to go back out there. I hadn't left anyways. I could still walk into Lefty's and the Budweiser would be sitting right there at my stool as soon as I pulled into the drive. Isn't it interesting? I thought that that was some kind of a note of arriving somewhere. They know me. They even know what I drink. I had a resentment, however, towards the tail end of my drinking days. And it was right at the time that Greg was born. April 18th, 1973. And I walked in this Easter Sunday into this place called the Underground Inn. And Moretta, who ran the bar, I started to sit down. She said, Hank, you don't sit there. She said, if you look down around the bar there, there's an Easter egg with your name on it. And I said, how did you know? How did you know I was going to be here? You know, I think drunks ain't too quick sometimes. We ain't watching. Somebody's watching, but we ain't. Talk about ending up in strange places. Oh, another spiritual, maybe a message there somewhere for me, but I still didn't get it. Greg was born in April, and it wasn't until August And you started getting to me because I had been attending your meetings. And I was sitting up at the Voyager. And I had a martini in front of me. And I was crying. And Sugar Bear, the guy that ran the place. Yeah, old Bear comes up to me and he said, "What's the matter, Hank?" I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And he said, that's okay. And the next day I'm in there for noon, trying to get back together. And Bear comes in. He said, "How you doing today?" I said, "Hey, doing great." He said, "You remember last night?" I said, "What about last night?" He said, "Last night you were an alcoholic." I said, "Bullshit." No, got me mixed up with somebody else. He said, "Well, that's what you said last night." It was in Dixon, Illinois, at a BFW. Mick McGuire, my bartender. God, I love Irish Catholics. I drank with Mick. That guy could put away some scotch, I'll tell you. And I needed one bad. I'd been on a week's drunk. And I'd gone out, and this time I wasn't messing around. I was going to convince everybody, those doubting Thomases, that Hank can drink. You know, at that time, even after going to meetings, I still couldn't seem to get a hold of I wanted to join AA, but I wanted to drink too. And it wasn't working. Didn't understand it. But I did understand it when I was at the VFW and I ordered a vodka and 7-Up, and Mick brought out one of those tall Tom Collins glasses. That's why I like Mick. Filled it about 7/8 full of vodka and splash some 7-Up on the top. We were good friends. And I picked the glass up and I put it to my lips and I couldn't drink it. And I set the glass down and I was feeling a feeling, and I'd been through car accidents and I'd been through barroom fights and all that nonsense, and all of a sudden I was hurting. And I went out and I sat in my car. And I sent up that prayer that I've heard from so many others, one way or another. I said, "God, help me." And it happened. And I didn't know. All I had to do was ask. I knew, and I don't know, except I knew that I better taper off this stuff. Otherwise, I've been close to DTs a lot of times. And so Saturday, Mary Lou reminded me. But first I called her and asked her if I could come home. I'd been gone a week, and she said, "Come on home." And I went home, and she reminded me I had tickets to a Cubs baseball game up in Chicago. That's a 120-mile drive from Princeton, but I took my son Hank up there. And that day I went up there, also buried one of my bartender buddies up in Chicago, Stan Samborski, and Stan died too early. Stan died from alcoholism. And we went to that funeral on the way home. And after the funeral, I stopped, saw a couple of the guys that used to hang out at that same gin mill. And I had a draft beer and a couple of fingers of brandy. And I didn't want to drink, but I knew that if I was going to get back to Princeton, Illinois, and if I wasn't going to go into DTs, I better. And I threw those down. I made it back home. And I didn't drink on Sunday. And Monday, I swear he's got a marvelous sense of humor where this kid's concerned. Monday, I'm sitting in a place in the north end of Princeton. It's called the Liars Club. And I had 2 glasses of draft beer. And I could feel those nerve endings going down. And I knew at that moment that physically I was going to be all right. And I'm tremendously grateful to my friend Eddie Bryant. Eddie B. In the respect that when he kept nodding at me and smiling and saying, "Keep coming back," I knew exactly where the meetings were, what time. And although there was only 1 week at that time, I was so grateful for that. And another guy by the name of Ed was taking me over to LaSalle. And he started taking me meetings over there on Sunday mornings where they had a lead speaker type meeting. And the guy would talk or a gal, and then they'd go around a table. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, it's kind of nice. You get to know people a little better that way. And he was taking me to those meetings, and then I started going on my own. And I started meeting a lot of different people. And I met this guy by the name of Pete. And Pete, he would go with a carload or a station wagon. But he used it for different purposes. He had guys in it that went to different meetings all over our area. And I thought that was kind of neat. So I went with Pete and I met all these people at these different meetings. And I asked them if they would come help support our little group in Princeton, because there was only four or five guys. And again, no women at that time. And this is 1973. I mean, where were you? But every once in a while, we'd get a lady to come to our meeting in Princeton, and we'd all get excited. This woman, we got a girl coming in here. Now, I mean excited in a nice way. I mean, we were happy we were finally possibly going to get a woman member, because we would get a woman, and she wouldn't stay, because there weren't any other women. My friend Norma came along, Norma the RN. And I was so grateful for my friend Norma, because Norma stuck around. And thanks to Norma, a few other girls started coming and sticking around. And there are times today, folks, when we have more women at my home group than we have guys. Norma went to the Happy Hunting Grounds a couple years ago. But she was a GSR for our group. And she meant a lot to me and to Mary Lou. She's very close. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about her, but I want to tell you about another person who I met at that time. His name was Don F. And he stood about 5'2". God, I couldn't believe that any guy only 5'2" could have so much energy and drive me up a wall the way he did. And the reason being, he was my sponsor. Only I didn't ask him to be my sponsor. He decided he was going to be my sponsor because I was going over there on Sunday mornings to these meetings where he went. And the first thing he tells me is, clean the ashtrays and wash the cups. I don't remember volunteering to clean the ashtrays and wash the cups, but I did it because Don said I should do it. And then Don said I could help him by co-chairing on Sunday morning after I had 3 months sobriety. Wow! He said, now your job is to write down the first name of the persons who come in the door. So I have to get up and ask everybody. I don't know who everybody was. And then after I get it, I still had this minor problem. And I'd try to write their names, and I couldn't write, so I'd print their names. And then I'd give the list to Don, and he said, I can't read it. Then I'd get mad at him again. Why don't you write your own list? Then I graduated to where he allowed me to read how it works, to open a meeting. Now, we didn't do that in Princeton. I hadn't seen a big book. I'd never heard how it works. It was kind of foreign to me, and I wondered, how did they stay sober over there in Princeton as long as they did? The group had been around since 51, and Eddie B. explained it to me. Don had memorized how it works, my sponsor, and I thought, well, that little guy can put that to memory, so can I. And I'll do me, the kid. I recited how it works, and boy, was I proud of me. And I recited how it works around Eddie B., just to let him know how good I was doing and coming along. Eddie B. and I are riding along in my car. I'm taking him home. And I said, you know, Eddie, I kind of noticed that there was no big book when I first came around the Princeton group, and they don't read how it works like they do over in Princeton or over in LaSalle. And Eddie said, well, yep, I read the big book. He said, I didn't agree with everything I read in there. Now, this time, Eddie's got 25 years sobriety. And I said, yeah. He said, yeah. I said, well, what about how it works? He said, you like that? He said, well, there are some people who memorize that. He said, but all I can tell you I really know about the steps. He said, I had been stepping in the wrong direction. I said, don't lay that on me so simple. I mean, don't tell me that you don't have to work the steps. He gave me my first lesson in the fact that how other people work the steps or understand how it works ain't truly a whole lot of my affair. My business is, how do I understand what you're saying to me? God love him. I think one of the big spiritual experiences that I had was after not too long sober, and I had worked your steps for a 3.5 step program. And it was working great. I had 1, half of 2, 11 and 12. I've been even doing some 12-stepping. And then I heard this lady who somebody had mentioned by the name of Neva from our state. And Neva was speaking up at this place. I'd gone to my first meeting at King's House. And she said, at least I thought I heard her say this. I'm standing up in the back of the room. And it's just like in my Baptist church back in Schaumburg when the preacher is looking right at me. And there she seemed like she's looking right through me. And she says, if you're not working all 12 steps of the AA program, you may be working a program, but it's not AA, is it your own? Why is she looking at me? How does she know that I am not doing that other stuff? Mary Lou and I had a conversation, and the only thing wrong with me, we decided, was I drank too much. Outside of that, I was a sterling character. And of course I agreed. I sat down, I wrote a 4-step inventory, and I immediately called a guy by the name of Sam from over in Ottawa. And we had, Sam is a nice guy. He lives somewhere here in Florida now. But Sam, beautiful guy, I said to him what I wanted to do, and would you meet me over LaSalle, and I wanted to take a 5th. And we went over there, and we met at the club there in LaSalle, and we had this marvelous understanding before I took my first 5th step. And I said, Sam, I'm going to do this thing because I know I have to do this thing. I really feel this. But I want you to know that if you laugh or say anything smart, I'll punch your lights out. Now, if you're agreeable to that, let's get on with it. And he laughed at me, and I did it. And I did stuff. I told him stuff. I swear to God. Well, I didn't swear to you. I wasn't going to tell him. I wasn't going to tell anybody some of the stuff I had done. But I did, and I did it to the best of my ability at that time. And I heard it said around the tables, and I started to experience it. I can live with my yesterdays, not in them. And I thought, and I started to feel that. Only it didn't happen immediately. It took a little time for this to sink in. And God gave me a guy by the name of Carl. And Carl asked me to sponsor him. And the beauty of this program, I don't think that I really sponsored Carl. I think Carl sponsored me. Because in the close relationship that he and I were able to build together, he shared with me who he was and allowed me to share with him everything. I thought I'd taken a 5th with Sam. Not really. It was an honest attempt, but what Carl and I shared, I can never show enough appreciation to that man. He went out to California some years ago, and we never heard from him anymore. Wherever he is, I am so grateful for the moments that we had together, because we traveled the road for 3 years before he took off. And the experience of that was great for me, and turning loose is so much of this stuff that I didn't know. My wife said she didn't know who she was Friday. And I think to myself, I thought I knew who I was when I was drinking. I guess I thought, because I told everybody who I thought I was. And I sounded a lot better than I really looked at the time. I didn't know how sick I was. I didn't know how much I was going to learn from a book I picked up. And I hadn't read it all, but I read this part in it that at the beginning of the 5th chapter, Bill wrote in a grapevine, in fact, way back in 57, is sobriety all that we are to expect of a spiritual awakening? He said, no, sobriety is only a bare beginning. It is only the first gift of the first awakening. It is, if more gifts are to be received, our awakening has to go on. As it does go on, we find that bit by bit we can discard the old life, the one that did not work, for a new life that can and does work under any conditions. Whatever. Any conditions. Started going to more meetings and meeting more people. And Norma said, let's get involved. She became the GSR for the group, and she said, you can be my alternate. And I said, Norma, dear, I don't want anything to do with the politics of this organization. And I made that quite clear. She heard it, and she laughed too. And he heard it, and he's been laughing ever since. It's like saying that I won't chair a meeting, right? I'm not going to that meeting. The fun of AA is meeting some of the people and in early in sobriety and sitting around the tables and hearing how it works, and that there are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. And I was getting well and I could pick you out. I didn't know how sick I really was. I honest to God didn't. But love and patience, I couldn't believe the kind of love and patience that I was getting around the groups and meeting all these different people from all over. And then when Norma finally did talk me into being the alternate, then the excitement really started to happen. I started to read some literature. The big book. Don kept saying I should read the big book. But that was written back in 38. What? This is 1974, 75. What do I need with the big book? I had the steps. They read how it works. That's the page there. That's all I needed. Pete called. Pete from the Valley. And he said, we've got a lady over here in the hospital. She's going home and she lives in your town. And I want you to get her to meetings. And I had a minor ego problem early in sobriety. And I thought, Pete called me to save Diane. And boy, oh boy, did we go to meetings. I mean, we went all over Ottawa, Mendota, Spring Valley, down to King's House. But Norma, Diane wasn't staying sober. And I didn't understand what was going on. I mean, here I am taking her all these meetings. Finally, it dawned on me what Don had said to me. That's the key. I got a big book. Gave it to Diane. I said, Diane, read the book. We lived in the same town. A week later, Diane came to me and she said, I read the book. What did you think of it? I read the big book. Then because of getting involved, thanks to Norma, I started reading some of the other 12 and 12 and I was enjoying reading all this good stuff, and boy, I was getting smart. You know, I was getting so smart that as they were having elections around in LaSalle, I was on their steering committee. I was the alternate GSR for my home group. And then they were having a meeting, a district meeting, and I attended one, and they were looking for a DCM. District committee member. And I said, oh, that's interesting. What do they do? They said they go to these committee meetings and assemblies. I said, oh. Great. I want it. Friend Frank from Mendota, he took the job. And then they wanted an alternate for Frank, and I said, what's the alternate do? Oh, well, when Frank can't make it, he goes. I said, Frank's retired. I can be an alternate DCM and go back to my home group and tell them I'm the alternate DCM? Sounded good. I'll take that job. A week later, Frank called. He'd been talking to his missus, and he really didn't think that he could do that. I said, hello? Now, listen, I didn't want that much, but I was a DCM. And it was really a growing experience because, again, I started meeting more people. And I go to these district meetings, or these area committee meetings, these area assemblies, and it was so much fun. I didn't know that ex-drunks could have so much fun trying to think what's best for us as a whole in just our little district and our little area. But they would fight. Oh, my goodness, they would say, everybody, what you're doing wrong. Ralph was one of the troublemakers we had at those area committee meetings and assemblies. He knows what I'm talking about. We had a big deal over whether we were going to call it a conference or I don't know what we were going to call it, but we had some crazy, wonderful kind of discussions. And the funny thing is, everybody that was attending there, in as much noise as was being made, everybody was staying sober. I thought, boy, this is really fun. You know. And then that's when I heard, it's okay to disagree, but I don't have to be disagreeable. Something like that. I thought, hey, that's okay. I like that. I think it was at that time I realized, after I'd been doing it for a couple of years, how important it had become to my sobriety. that just by going there and being around these people and doing what they told me to do. They said, we're going to give you some information to take back to your district and then take back to your group, and that's all you are, as a messenger. I can handle that. That's great. And it was fun, like I say, meeting all these beautiful people. And then a few years ago, I had the opportunity to serve as delegate from Northern Illinois area and go to New York. I was going to say go to Chicago. Sorry about that, New York. But there again, I thought, wow, what a tremendous experience here. Such marvelous people from all over the country now. More friends. Her name is Ruth P. She lives out in Green Valley, Arizona. I don't know if any of you know my friend Ruthie. And Ruthie said just that. As we get involved, as we get out of ourselves, and we start doing things, so much is given back by the relationships that we are able to make as we go along. And the number of friends that we care about and care about us, and how it just seems to grow and grow. And I've experienced that. But I had one problem, and I'm not going to talk much longer. I had one problem I wanted to share with you, and I got it out of here, an answer for my problem out of another book. It's only been out a year and a half. Came out in November of 89, and called The Language of the Heart. And I appreciate that Scott loaned it to me, because I like to remind myself of something I found in here for me. I wear this turtle here because... Probably the fact my dad's a Mohawk Indian, but my wife bought it for me when we were up visiting in Canada in the reserve. And it happened to be the clan my father came from. And it seems to fit me so well, the way I've learned things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have some good news for you. I think you are getting better. Mary Lou's gotten better. I couldn't believe. I was riding back from one of these meetings in LaSalle, and my friend who was riding with me had just gotten a divorce, and he was telling me all about the problems he'd had with his ex-wife. And here I'd been in this relationship with Mary Lou for a number of years, and I was going to tell him, do you think you've got problems? I've been sober 3 years, and my wife is... And this feeling came over me. And I stopped saying anything to this guy, and the feeling was... I guess I must have picked it up around here somewhere. Why don't you take your own inventory and leave her to me? And I thought, is it just a feeling, or did I really hear something here? Strange thing come of that. I've got a note here that says, one thing I do want to remember is to thank Helen and Harry from your archives. If you hadn't seen it out here, I think they've done a nice job in displaying some artifacts, some archives out here. And I wanted to thank them for sharing some of your history with me, because I'm presently the archivist up there in Northern Illinois. And with what they've already done, they're kind of helping me to maybe put some history together for our area. I got to reading so much as delegate. Thank God not all delegates are like this delegate. But they said at New York, before you come to the conference, would you please read and reread our literature? And being the dutiful son that I have become, I read it all. I was the PI chairman for a couple of years back in the early, mid-80s, and I read all the pamphlets then, because I thought, if you're the PI chairperson, you ought to know about all this stuff, and I was ready to tell you. Ask me about a pamphlet so I can tell you. Still had a minor problem. I had that same problem, I think, when I got to New York, because I was better dressed than my wife. I took more clothes to New York. Mary Lou and I went there. I had this wardrobe. But I thought, if you're going to represent the area, you ought to look pretty when you're doing it. Buck B. from Indiana said that. He said, if you're going to stand up there, if you're going to stand up there sober, you ought to try to look sober. Well, by God, when I went to that conference, I'm going to tell you, I wasn't taking second seat to anybody up there. I was going to be dressing sharp, and I had three bags, and I had lots of suits, and I had to change for twice a day. We were only there a week. I had enough for 2 weeks. Mary Lou had a little bag we carried along. I got up there. I'd read all this material, and I got to thinking, isn't it marvelous now that I've read the 12 and 12 again, and I've read the big book, and I've read Pass It On, and, oh, I read AA Comes of Age, which turned me on to service. And, boy, what those guys did back then, in the beginning. And I was so excited about all of this. And I thought, isn't it marvelous? Now I've learned something about the concepts, which will be my closing, the 12 concepts for world service. And I will start with concept one. I'm not going to do that. Are you kidding? I already talked to Terry. He said, what time are you going to close this thing up? I said, I'll be done by 11:15. Don't worry about it, kid. So, anyways, I've learned all this stuff, and I've read all this stuff, and I go home to my home group. And our group's no different than anybody else's. Princeton AA group is no different. We've got people, I hate to tell you this, but we've got people coming to our meetings who are duly addicted. Hey. We even have some coming from, because the judge sent them. I got this piece of paper they want to sign, and they want to really be there, right? I know exactly how they feel. When we read that part and how it works, if you want what we have, and you look at them, and they're going, are you kidding? They don't even know if they're alcoholic. But I was going to help them. Got to my home group, and I was going to decide who belonged and who didn't. Who could come in, who could stay, what you could say and what you couldn't. Now, you have to do a lot of reading and a lot of thinking and not much praying to get where I was. But you see, I was being responsible. The other newer people in my group didn't know all that I knew. And I was going to help them. And I was doing just fine until this book came out. I've been tripping along quite well, and then I read this. Scotty, it's in here. The chapter says, the individual in relation to AA as a group. And I read this part where it's talking about the third tradition. It says, our membership ought to include all who suffer alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group. This clearly implies that an alcoholic is a member if he says so. That we can't deny him membership. That we can't demand from him assent. That we can't force our beliefs or practices upon him. That he may flout everything we stand for and still be a member. In fact, our tradition carries the principle of independence for the individual to such an apparently fantastic length that so long as there is the slightest interest in sobriety, the most unmoral, the most antisocial, the most critical alcoholic may gather about him a few kindred spirits and announce to us that a new Alcoholics Anonymous group has been formed. Anti-God, anti-medicine, anti-our recovery program, even anti-each other. These rampant individuals are still an AA group if they think so. And I said, God, thanks, Bill. Bill Wilson wrote that in 57, and I definitely needed it in 89 and 90. And when I read it, I realized it's not my job. And if I could just remember what it was like when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't think I belonged here, and I didn't want to be here. I came from Mary Lou, and somebody said, it won't work if you come that way, and obviously they were right, it didn't. But there are a lot of Eddie B's in the fellowship of AA, who may not understand what I think I understand, may not practice what I think I should practice. But thank God for Eddie. And thank God for the love and the patience and the tolerance of the members of the LPOS group who've lived with me for a while and the Princeton group. And the fact that there was so much love, so much patience, so much tolerance. I kept waiting while they read the promises here a few times. There's a part right after it, and I got it out of the grapevine. They were playing trivia a few years ago in the grapevine, and there was that part that it said, "What is the motto of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I'd read all the literature. I'm supposed to be able to answer these, you know, Trivial Pursuit. And I couldn't remember. Thank God the grapevine was kind. It said, "The answers are all in the issue you just read." So I thumbed back through there and I found it was on page 84, right after the promises. It said, "Love and tolerance of others is our code." That's the motto. And I thought, wow. And the way it's practiced, and the way I have sensed it and felt it, and what it has given us, because Mary Lou and I'm happy to report to you, there's no 2 o'clock in the morning sessions unless we want to stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning. But it's been years since we've done that. And instead of her just being the mother of our children, instead of her just being my wife, thanks to you folks, she's become my friend, my pal. And we're learning a lot about communication still. We've been together 36 years, and I know everything there is to know about her. And yet, there's so much more to learn, because she keeps changing. Thank you, Al-Anons. She keeps changing, and what you've given her, she also shares with me. So though I don't go to Al-Anon meetings, I'm one of those double winners, too, via the back door. But it's that kind of love that you've had, and you've shared with her, that I also am a recipient of. I know I'm in the right place. God knows I'm in the right place. It took me a while to get here, but like Mary Lou said in her closing, she's so grateful for what she's been given that you can be guaranteed you'll see her around the tables for a long time to come, God willing. Thank you very much. God bless you.